Hey there, and welcome to the Smart and Simple Matters show with your host, Joel Zaslavsky. This is episode 49. This is episode 49? Yeah, I guess it is. We're one away from the big 50, but don't skip this one. It's wild, baby. Maybe I've been listening to a little too much of Vernon Foster's Event Supremacy podcast lately, but as Vernon would say, and what I say to you today, welcome, welcome, and again, I say welcome. It's been a while since I hit the money-wise side of Simplify, Organize, and Be Money-Wise, but I'm hitting it hard with my guest today, Luna Jaffe. She joins me in a moment for a talk on wild money and reevaluating your relationship, get this, with money itself. And I actually offered myself up as a case study for Luna to dissect because we discuss one of my biggest money hangups by far. And what do we conclude? Well, you'll hear for yourself in a moment. I got to tell you, though, I'm really excited about this episode and proud of how powerfully, concisely, and persuasively Luna tackles some crazy hard topics. And as soon as we stopped recording, I had to resist the urge to ask her for another 45 minutes. I mean, right then and right there to record a second episode. It's that good. Now, are you ready to learn how a lifetime of accidents can create some deep intention? Would you like to know why you shouldn't judge how good or bad you are with money? Hey, perhaps you care to join the hot debate between whether you should go for enough or plenty. Well, one thing's for sure, you're about to hear the voice of money speak. And I think you'll appreciate what it has to say. Here we go. Welcome to the show, you groovy listener, you. I'm feeling a rare level of vibrancy right now because my guest today is Luna Jaffe. Luna holds a passionate conviction that your relationship with money is critical to having a successful and satisfying life. She's a certified financial planner and award-winning author of Wild Money, A Creative Journey to Financial Wisdom. Luna also has a master's degree in psychology and is the founder and CEO of Lunaria Financial in Portland, Oregon, where she offers securities and advisory services through KMS Financial Services Incorporated. By the way, did I mention that her work has been featured in Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and numerous radio shows? You're going to dig this, folks. Luna, welcome to Smart and Simple Matters.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start where we always start, which is what I call the seeds of awesomeness, so that people can have a little more context. Can you tell us maybe one or two experiences that you had growing up or something specific about your environment as a youth that helps us understand who you are now?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that I have never been one to take a conventional path, even though I've tried. And when I graduated from college with a degree in bilingual education, I promptly recognized that teaching elementary school kids was not really what I wanted to do and said, well, what's the next thing that I would want to do? And I decided to hitchhike on a boat and sail as far as I could get. And so I basically hitchhiked from California to Florida via Canada. I know, odd. And then went and hung out on a dock in Coconut Grove, Florida, until I found a boat that was going somewhere and didn't really even know where, and just got on and as crew and started sailing on this little tiny 36-foot sloop with two other people. And we sailed for 6 months through the Caribbean. Had an amazing experience. And then I jumped to another boat and crossed the Atlantic and sailed to Spain. So
wow. So not only do you take an unconventional route, you also take an indirect route to whatever it is that
perhaps
you're
going. Sometimes that would be the case. It's informed my life. I've done a ton of traveling. I love to be out there experiencing the world and seeing what comes forward and how to interact with people in a real way.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I have a similar story, but I had similar challenges growing up. My first decade after college was very conventional, working in a large corporation. You and I have a similar background in terms of working in the wealth management and financial industry. And I, unlike you, was pretty content for about a decade to just lead that conventional life until I decided that wasn't for me anymore. That wasn't where my impact would be. That's not where my purpose lay. But my transition was rough. And I would imagine as you went from trying to be conventional but not into who you are now, which is a very authentic person, did you have some struggles that you needed to overcome in the process?
Yeah, just a few. I mean, part of it was like, who am I? Like you were just saying, and I kind of went through that earlier, so I didn't do the 10-year corporate thing and then say, who am I? I basically traveled and then came back and was like, oh crap, now what? And really what happened to me was that I moved to Boston where I knew nobody and got a job using my language skills, which was great, but didn't like the job, but fell in love, absolutely fell in love and changed my complete life around a painting that I saw that was hanging outside of a new ceramic studio. And it was made of silk, hand-painted silk. And it totally just, I just looked at it and I was like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. Who knew? And I just walked in and I said, who did that? I need to know her. And they said, here's her name and number. I called her up. And she said, I said, can you teach me how to do that? I have to know how to do that. And she said, sure. So,
well, what was it about that singular thing that spoke to you so much?
I really have no idea, but things like that have hit me in my life. That's why I sort of consider myself not only an accidental artist, but also an accidental financial planner. I mean, I'm going along thinking that my life is this, and then something happens, but I absolutely know when I see it that it's the right place to be turning, even though it seems absolutely opposite of my skill set or my, you know, direction, experience, whatever. And being an artist was sort of one of those very, very secret passions of mine, but I never let myself explore it for some reason. I'm not even sure why. I explored it as a dancer and as a gymnast, but I was never able to let myself even take visual art classes, even though it was very deep inside of me as a like untapped love. So I think it was just one of those things where it just hit me. I went for it. I got the information. I tried it. I was like, I actually can do this. And within 6 months, I was making a living as a visual artist. So I know it's crazy. Well, and then I thought, oh, maybe I should go to school because I probably need the credibility of going to school and be, you know, going to art school. And I applied to art school and actually got in, which sort of floored me as well. And then I was there for a semester and I'm like, they're not teaching me what I want to learn. Why am I here? And I just said, why don't I spend the same money teaching myself? And so I did.
Well, hey, makes sense to me. Well, I loved reading your backstory in getting ready to give you a good interview here and your transitions. And I love the transitions, those in-between spaces. And you went from artist to dancer to therapist. And now you are still a lot of those things, but you're also a financial planner, an author, a speaker. You're a lot of things in a lot of different mediums, which as somebody who likes a diversity of mediums and topics and passions and interests, I can really respect. We're going to focus on a couple of them today, although we'll probably get into some territory that neither of us expect. I'd like to start with wild money. I see that all over the place, not just when I go to your website, but just in general. And I didn't really understand what my wild money was or the resources around this concept. Can you tell us a little bit about that first?
Well, yeah. So wild money started as, you know, one of those experiences when you're driving down the road and it just like lands on you. It's like, oh, my book's called Wild Money. And that was before I even had any idea what the book was about, but I just knew the name of it was Wild Money. And then I had a book coach who was phenomenally helpful. And, you know, his first question was the same thing. Like, so what the hell is Wild Money? And I was like,
good question.
I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And so it was this amazing process of really discovering that for me, what Wild Money, the wild in Wild Money is really about getting back to the way the wilderness is an ecosystem that works because it's in balance. And when we overly cultivate a natural space, we actually upset that natural balance. So wild as in untamed, but fully functioning ecosystem is sort of the way I frame the work that I do with money. And I help people look at all the different ways that we interact with money. Because I think it's so easy for us to just either say in a judgment, I'm good at it or I'm not good at it. And so what I do is say, well, what if I break it down into how do I receive money and where am I at in terms of receiving? Do I receive more than enough? Do I let it in or do I kind of push it away? What, how do I respond when I'm in the position of receiving money? We look at how do I spend it? Am I intentional or unconscious? How am I when I go to nurture it and take care of it? Can I sit with it? Can I let it pool around me like a really one of the greatest concepts that I've come across is if you envision money as a waterfall, that waterfall or that fountain, if you want to take a feng shui practice, the fountain is best, is considered most prosperous if there's a pool of water in that fountain or in that waterfall. And so instead of just cycling through, like everything that comes in goes back out, it's everything comes in and it pools and then it goes out over the sides because there's extra. I love that visual.
I like that too. Oh, well, yeah. Help me out here though. So we're talking a lot about the relationships with money and you've already described some people who I've heard this concept of money avoiders, money worshipers. There's all these different kinds of relationships that we could have. Personally, I went from a money worshiper to a money avoider. Right now, I have issues with getting people to pay. I create really good stuff, but it's hard for me to ask people to pay for it. I'm not asking you to give me a live session or anything like that or unpack my issues here. But I guess this concept of, you mentioned some people feel like they have more than enough. And I do. I feel like I have abundance around me financially, emotionally, spiritually, in pretty much every single way. And therefore, I don't need money. I don't pursue it. I have enough. And I kind of avoid it. How, if you were initially talking to somebody about their relationship with money, what kind of questions would you ask them to start to frame it properly in their head?
So I do several different things because I do break things down and ask questions around. So you just said some interesting things, for example. So you said, I have enough. And then you said, I avoid it. So to me, there's like, okay, that's interesting. You have enough, but you avoid it. So why do you avoid it? And I would have you actually draw an image of how you, where you are with money right now. I start pretty much every conversation with clients or with people I'm coaching with a visual image. And that's because it accesses the preverbal places in us. We don't necessarily have the language for how we feel about money. It's much more complex on some levels than the words that we have. So for example, the other day I had a couple that I was working with and the man had drawn a picture of, hit drawn, whatever that word was I just said. He drew a picture of a little blue marble on a concrete slab. And he said, this is my relationship with money. And I looked at it and I said, okay, tell me more. And he said, my relationship with money is inside of this marble. It's a potential that hasn't been tapped. And I'm just waiting for somebody to find me. Hmm. Okay, now that's a very different perspective than if I had said, you know, how are you with money? And he might have said, I'm really overwhelmed. So for to go from I'm really overwhelmed, which is a kind of a mental construct of how he feels, to I'm a little blue marble with, and he also went so far as to say, it's not one of those pretty marbles, it's really plain. I'm a plain marble waiting for someone to notice me. So he's speaking of his pain, really. He's speaking of his pain around feeling like part of what he's doing around money isn't getting acknowledged. He's also speaking about how small his relationship with money feels right now. There's this sense of tightness. And he was able to tease that out into a much more robust understanding of really what money is all about for him. And then once you do that, once that initial image is formed, it's the next step is to say, what's something you can change to make it feel different or better? Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is that, you know, I might come up with something that I think he could change, but that doesn't matter. What I can change is irrelevant. What matters is where does his unconscious take him about how it needs to change? So he might want to open it up. He might want to make it bigger. He might want to add himself as a person in the picture because it's a very stark image. He might want to put the marble in somebody else's hand. You know, there's so many different options. So how I would work with you is by starting with that picture because you're explaining to me that there's a conflict going on inside of you.
There is.
But yeah, because you don't want to talk. You're kind of, you don't want to deal with it. But you said there's plenty. Well, you said there's enough, actually. You didn't say there's plenty.
There is plenty and there is enough.
Okay. See, I'm trying to get away from the word enough in my world because enough is sufficient, right? It's just sufficient. Whereas the word plenty is beyond sufficient. It's an ample amount of whatever it is. Does that make sense?
It does, but okay, now, wow. All right, I'm going to have to unpack that one for a second. So isn't enough where we find a lot of contentment, though, where we're not looking for more when we're not aspiring to plenty? Don't we experience a lot of gratitude and contentment? And or do you encourage people to get to a point where they feel that there's plenty as opposed to just enough?
Well, let me give you an example of the difference between plenty and enough, because this is really, really, so I've been so enjoying this process of my whole year is about living in a world of plenty and what the difference is. So if you think about having enough savings, and I say, oh, I have enough savings, and I ask clients all this all the time, how much savings do you have and how do you know if that's an ample amount or plenty or whatever the word is at the time that I'm talking to them. So if you have $5,000 in savings and you tell me that that's enough, and then you have a $4,500 vet bill, so you do have enough to pay the vet bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you pay the vet bill and now you have $500 left. Now, one, no longer do you have enough. And two, it's pretty demotivating. Now, if you compare that to having plenty of savings and you have $25,000 in savings and you have a $4,500 vet bill, you can pay the vet bill and not feel devastated by it.
True.
So what I aim to help people with is it's not that we need $1 million in the bank necessarily to live the life we want to live. But if we understand that part of being a responsible grown-up around money is to understand that life is unpredictable. And we have to build flexibility and resilience into our lives in order to navigate that we can't predict. It just happens. So how do you do that? You got to make sure you have plenty of resources, plenty of healthcare, plenty of retirement. But again, it's like plenty doesn't mean an excessive amount.
Okay, that is perfect because I wanted to ask you, you have a resource called Z Guide to Money and you talk about we all have a life that we want to live. And of course, money is essential to get there, which I totally agree with. But I want to know what you recommend we can do to feel like we need less plenty in order to have the life we want to live. Is that something that you deal with?
Well, I'm not sure I would say less plenty. I don't want less plenty, but I think that the plenty that we want in our lives has more to do with experiences and less to do with money. So if I write a list of what makes my life feel rich, not doesn't make me feel rich, but makes my life feel rich, the things I write down when I do this exercise are things like getting a massage every week, hanging out with my friends or my child freely, like just feeling like there's spaciousness around time. Mm-hmm. So plenty of time actually equates far more to a sense of quality of life than plenty of money in the bank. But to get plenty of time, you have to be more relaxed around the money that you have. So there's this really interesting dynamic around it. And so what I do with people is I try to help them define what does that life look like and feel like? What experiences are you wanting? And so some people want experiences like traveling in Europe might be one person's experience of, wow, if I'm living with plenty, I am spending 4 months a year in Europe. Now, spending 4 months a year in Europe is a lot more expensive than spending 4 months a year in Peru, right? And so you're going to have different needs in terms of where it is that you visualize yourself in the world. But so our needs around plenty are different depending on who we are.
Yeah.
But they relate to experiences. If I want to spend time with my 15-year-old and I want to be able to take him to see the world, that takes money. And if I want to feel like I have plenty of money to do that, then that's something I'm going to work for. It's going to be worth it for me to work for it. Because one of my values, for example, is that I feel like the more I expose my child to the world, the better citizen he's going to be. The more aware of the world, more open-minded he'll be. So that's where I might spend my money. Somebody else might spend their money on private school education because they want that education to come from the school system. Mm-hmm.
And someone else like me might try to figure out how they can spend money to get their 3.5-year-old to get dressed in less than half an hour every morning.
That too.
That's a challenge I'm working on right now. If anybody's listening knows how to resolve that
issue, there's other techniques for that, right?
I love Grant so much, but oof, in the morning, that guy, I tell you. Well, one thing's for sure. I know just from knowing the industry and from hearing you, you're definitely not the traditional certified financial planner, both in terms of your approach and the kinds of words that you use. And I know that you also don't approach financial literacy like the typical folks, at least that I have been exposed to in the past, would. These people who pound their chest and say, I'm an expert, listen to me, I'm awesome. How does what you teach differ from what's commonly found out there?
Well, what's commonly found out there is a focus on your asset allocation, your risk tolerance, your goals. And most of the people that I've met in my 10 years of being in this business is many people, well, certainly risk tolerance doesn't even make sense. They don't understand.
Can you
understand
what that is for people who aren't familiar with
it? Yeah, so risk tolerance is, and in the industry, it's also defined by terms they don't even understand. So the idea of risk tolerance is, how am I going to behave if the market goes up or down more or less? So if I see myself as someone who's a conservative investor, I'm going to have less tolerance to fluctuations in the market than someone who basically invests in stocks and turns their head the other way and says, it's all going to be good. I'm going to look at it again in 10 years. Or I'm comfortable looking at it all the time because I recognize that the market goes up and down. But my belief system is that over time, stocks do better and I'm worth, you know, I'm fine with that up and downness. It doesn't freak me out. I don't have to pull my money out of the market. So we use risk tolerance in the industry to help people make investments that they can stick with. Because anytime somebody makes an investment and constantly pulls out at the wrong time due to emotional reasons, typically loses money. So that's risk tolerance. I actually define it more. I use a questionnaire in my book that's called the Comfort Zone Quiz, and I look more at, who are you as a human being? How do you behave in the ocean, for example? Are you the person who dips your toes in the water? Are you the person that gets out on the surfboard even though a year ago there was a shark attack there? You know, how do you operate? There's some people that might only be standing on the balcony of the hotel because there was a tsunami warning last year and they are not going there. Mm-hmm. And so what I do is try to help look at, really, who are you at the core? Because that's going to tell me how you invest in part. And the other piece of how you invest has to do with the time that you have for that money to be invested. So if you only have a 2 or 3 year time frame, you should, and your professional advisor should be guiding you differently if that time frame is very short versus if that time frame is 30 or 40 years. Okay. You can take more risk with 30 years than you can with 2. You probably shouldn't even buy stock with 2 years, depending on, you know, what your goals are. So I'm different because I'm really looking at people's emotional relationship with money. I'm really using their internal creative resources to help them gain more understanding so that as they operate in the world around their money and their monthly cash flow as well as their investments, they're actually lining up both with their values and with their deeper dreams, not just the surface dreams of, oh, I think I should retire or send my kid to school, but like really dig into it.
I like that approach because the mechanics of managing your money or your investments, your budget, whatever it is, those are pretty easy. It's process, it's systems, and understanding how they work together. But the mindset that you take to it, the big reason why behind it all, that's the really tricky part. And I'm still, we all are. I don't think anyone ever feels like, I have a perfect relationship with this thing called money. We might feel that our relationship with our best friend is great, or our spouse, or whatever it may be. But I've never met somebody who says, I have resolved every single issue or every single concept around money that I can potentially encounter. One thing
I don't think that's possible. I mean, that would be like saying that my marriage is perfect. Because nobody's marriage is perfect. I mean, we might have a fabulous working relationship and we've grown through the last 25 years or whatever it is, and we know each other so well, but we also invite the curiosity about how each of us is growing. I mean, to me, that is the goal, not perfection, because there's no such thing.
Yeah. Well, I have
whether it's your money or it's your wife. It's
true. Well, my wife, Melinda, if you're listening, I know she normally doesn't listen, but honey, you are darn near perfect. I would say that, and I do say that to you. I would say that to thousands of people. She's just amazing. Okay, I digress though. We're having fun. One of the reasons why I was really excited to have you on the show is there's something coming up that you are involved in. I just have the teeniest little inkling of what it's about and what it could be, but I'm sure you have a better understanding. You're producing and performing in something called the Wild Money Monologues and helping people develop their money story. What's the deal with that?
Yeah, well, so as I've gone through this process, well, so one, I come from a background of having been a professional dancer, and then when I was kind of tired of being somebody else's paintbrush on a canvas, which is what it felt like to be a dancer in somebody else's choreography, I then about 5 years after I quit being a dancer, I wrote and created a one-woman show. And so I'd had this experience of doing performance as a personal process, and it was very transformative. And so when I was really, after I'd launched my book and I was kind of looking at what is my like gigantic, outrageous, audacious dream, and what came up for me was, how can I make the conversation around money more accessible and more transformative, and what vehicle will that be most easily communicated in? And since I do love performing, and I felt like, you know, maybe I should try this and just see what happens. And so I waited until my book was launched, and I was like, okay, I think I've done all that stuff that I can do around the book. I tend to be one of those people that once there's a creative project on the forefront, then, you know, everything else sort of pales in comparison. So I have to do that. I had to wait until there was kind of the right time and energy and resources available. But what I did was I invited individuals that I knew, a few clients, friends, even someone I didn't even know, but I just got this sense of like, she's going to be really fill another piece of this story. So we have a woman who's 74. The youngest woman is 30. It is all women telling stories. But what we've done is we've, in the process of creating this performance, and it's like anything, it's a blank canvas. I mean, I came into this theater and said, well, here's sort of the general vision I have, but what I'm going to do is invite each of you to start exploring your money stories and find the one that seems to be most either troublesome or sort of vexing at the moment. Like, what's the one that just kind of, you know, kind of gets you and you're still struggling with it? And so we started playing with those, and we've done this process where we're weaving our stories together in a couple ensemble pieces. So there's individual monologues, but there's also this woven piece. And what's stunning about it is the amount of insight that we've all gained from the process, which is really my intention. My intention is, not only do I want us to grow, but I want the audience to think about their relationship with money in a way that they never have before.
Yeah, so let me get selfish for a moment. As somebody who would attend, what's in it for me? What changes for me if I craft my own money story?
The capacity to be self-aware is phenomenal. So listening to somebody tell their story of how they've had their head in the sand around money and finding the root of that might inspire you as a participant or an audience member to say, oh man, I am so there. I have so done that. And I can kind of see, having heard that transformational story, I can kind of see that it would benefit me to do that work or to start to think about the ways that my own money story is impacting my choices around the money that I have to manage or invest. So I want to spark people. Like, I've invited quite a few of my clients to come with a family member. You know, bring your spouse, bring your daughter, bring your mom, and hopefully afterwards there's going to be a conversation that started. It's like, wow, did you hear that story? Like that one just like totally, wow. You know, That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for people to just hopefully...
People ending sentence as in just, wow.
Yeah, like what? Really? I never considered that before. And one of the interesting things that's come out of this performance that's super fun is that we decided one time in a rehearsal, let's be money. Let's be the voice of money. And let's talk about what money's experience of this relationship is. And wow, was that insightful. Because one of the women, she goes, you know, being money, she's like, you know, you never touch me anymore. I'm just a bunch of ones and zeros flipping through the lines and I never materialize. Huh. And it was like, holy guacamole.
can I have you back on the show for another episode to talk about what it's like to be money?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's a perspective I've never contemplated.
Well, and it start again, it's a relationship and we consider this, you know, money is neutral. Money reflects us as we are. And so it's a hard mirror to look in sometimes because we don't always like what we see. But it's neutral. But if we actually start to think of it as embodied in some way, then, you know, it's like right after we did that piece, I was like, you know, I went to the bank and I took out $1,000 in cash. And I just wanted to hold on to cash for a little bit. Just as like, what is it like to feel $1,000 in cash? And it's pretty stunning. We really don't touch money very much anymore. We very rarely pause to experience money coming in or money being held or money being handed to the next person, physically handing them money.
Well, when you say we, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I get the sense based on the monologues and the fact that they're all women that you're doing it with and just seeing a lot of the folks that you interact with, maybe women, at least the folks that you're encountering, have a more twisted relationship with money than men, because it seems like you really attract and appeal to women so much. Not to say that you don't, men. I, as a man, I can say that you really appeal to me and your words appeal to me, but is there something different about our gender that makes money so different in our heads?
That's a great question. Yes, I do think that there are things that are different about money for men and women. I think there's different stories that we get. And but do I think that, you know, if you were sitting in the audience listening to 8 women's money stories, you wouldn't get just as much out of it as a woman? Absolutely. Yeah, you would totally get. I mean, there's so much relevance and understanding. It's like, you know, part of the inspiration for doing Wild Money Monologues came from watching Vagina Monologues. And so somebody could say, hey, this whole performance was designed for women about women, except that when men went to that show, they were blown away by what they learned about how women feel about their own bodies, which translated into them being better at communicating with their own partners. So yes, there are some different ways that women embody money and money stories. Are they any more complex or messed up around it than men? No. That's, you know, they're just, sometimes the stories are different. I think are the messages that women in particular tend to be stuck on is a sense of not valuing themselves well. Although what you mentioned early in this conversation was that you sometimes have a hard time getting paid, which is something I hear more from women. So that was curious to me.
Well, the weird thing is I'm overly confident, maybe even delusionally confident in myself and what I can do for the world to be a positive impact. Yet that doesn't manifest itself in terms of money. And going from a corporate world where it was all about the money to leaving that and now kind of not wanting to have anything to do with it because I almost feel tainted by my decade in corporate America and pursuing it so much. Like I said, this isn't, we don't have to get into this right now, but one thing that I do like to do periodically during the show, and I haven't done this for a while, is just talk about kind of the lighter side, the fun side. Obviously, our conversation's been rather light, even though we've been exploring some awfully deep stuff here. I know you mentioned towards the start about your experiences in traveling, and you've had some amazing experiences. as far as I know, this doesn't have anything to do with minimalism or simple living or money, but what's it like to ride through a herd of rhinos in Nepal on the back of an elephant?
Yeah, you know, life just happens sometimes. You do just, you know, I ended up in Asia with my fiance at the time, and we went with the idea that we were going to be in Thailand for a month or two, and we didn't come back until 9 months later. And that was one of those travel experiences where it was just, we just went wherever we wanted to. We had enough financial reserves to, it wasn't a lot of money to travel in Asia at the time. And, you know, thus I ended up on a rhino in the middle of the Terai in Nepal. amongst other things. On that trip, I also met Mother Teresa. I met the Dalai Lama.
In the same month, from what I understand.
In the same month. There were just a lot of experiences that when you allow yourself to simply be unfettered by time, things can happen because you're just like, hey, so-and-so is going to be there. And you're like, cool, let's get on a bus and go see the Dalai Lama. That sounds fun.
Time is such a crazy construct. Money is a human construct. No other animal has money. They might have currency, although not in the way we think about it. We are the only animals that perceive time. You know, birds never show up late to something. Dogs, although my two dogs wake up in the morning wondering where their food is, we just perceive this concept of time so fundamentally differently than anything else in the world. It's really cool what happens when you just kind of throw that out the window for a period of time. Pun intended.
Yeah,
and what great things can happen when you don't let time dictate your day or who you're spending it with or what your priorities are. That's really cool.
Well, I mean, time or money, right? I mean, the other one of my mentors, he created a project where he said it's called $10 on a laptop. And he was a multimillionaire and he just said, I'm going to give it all away and start with $10 on a laptop and see what happens and see how many businesses I can start. And, you know, it's like we have so many ideas that you have to, you know, it takes money to make money and you got to have the right connections and blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't. It takes resourcefulness.
Who is that? The person?
Greg Hartle.
Yes, I've heard of Greg before.
Yeah.
I think I heard him on Srini Rao's
yes,
podcast.
Yes, exactly.
And he and
exactly.
Srini have done some pretty cool things together. Really, really cool dude. Haven't met him yet.
I went to the Instigator Experience a month ago that they put on. And that was, he was by and far the most exceptional speaker there. And because he had so many ideas, he really understands business in such a brilliant way that, you know, one of his strongest messages was you need to be resourceful, not use your resources. And so many people start a business by saying, I think I'll just use my entire 401k or, you know, let me use all my savings. And he's like, no, you don't need to do that. And you don't need a website. You don't need a brand. You don't need a business card. You just need to offer your service and make money. And once you're making money, then you can start to think about those things. But not until then. It's so backwards from the way we're taught.
That's really cool. I'm not a huge Tony Robbins fan, but he has a TED Talk where he talks about how it's all about resourcefulness and not resources. I'll actually link to it in the show notes because I don't know how Greg would approach it, maybe in a similar way, maybe in a different way, but I found it just fascinating and it really shifted my mindset in terms of what do I really need to make an impact on the world? Not a lot. How can I be resourceful with what I already have, which is a ton, to make my stamp and to leave a legacy for folks who come before me and come after me. Yeah, cool stuff. Well,
yeah, and yeah.
Go if you'd like to follow that up, that's great.
No, I was just going
to
say, so much of what stops people from making money is we get hung up in wanting to get paid before we've actually offered something. And so, one of Greg's really what he demonstrated in $10 on a laptop was, when you offer something first, like one of his first ways of making money when he just, you know, gave everything up and sat at Pike Place Market in Seattle and said, okay, here I am. He basically just got online, went onto Craigslist and said, I'm really great at helping people get jobs. I will help you get a job. You get 30 minutes of my time. You don't have to pay me anything, but if at the end of it you feel like it was valuable, then pay me what you can. And I mean, it's just a brilliant concept. And, you know, people were blown away by what they got from him. And he like helped, I don't know, 1,200 people get jobs. Some ridiculous number of people who are so grateful to him that they're probably still giving him money because they're grateful.
Yeah. Wow.
But he started out by offering something, not by asking,
mm-hmm.
which is a very different way to do business. And so there's there's a lot of that out there. And I think that shift between what you're talking about, you're in the corporate world, and there's, I think there's a level of entitlement that comes in the corporate world. It's like you get used to being sort of wined and dined, or you get your training paid for, or you get whatever. And you get into self-employment and you're like, whoa, I got to pay for all this. Not only do I have to pay for it all, but I have to keep track of my taxes, and I have to pay myself for my 401k or whatever. And I have to save for, you know, there's so many more structures that are required. And in a way, what your skill set is with the spreadsheets is like brilliant, because most people do not have that systems approach.
Yeah, I worked in operations. I don't want to bash corporate America. I enjoyed my time there, and I feel like I did good work. And a lot of the skills that I use now are come from my corporate background. My love of spreadsheets, I talk about this in my book, about how I think it's because every other email I sent in my corporate days, there was a spreadsheet attached. And I don't even use fancy formulas or pivot tables or any of that stuff. I just use it for sorting and filtering and all of these things which make organizing, not just your thoughts, but your experiences, so much easier. Yeah.
I love it. I can't wait to learn it from you.
Okay, well, cool. Hopefully other people.
I am not a spreadsheet geek, and I'm not a numbers geek either, which is very fascinating for a financial planner. And so in a way that, you know, one of the things that I think of a lot is the people that come natively to something are not often the best teachers of it. You know, somebody, like I was just talking with a friend of mine who tried being a financial planner, and then she was just like, you know, I just can't do this. And what was fascinating is she's great at money. And I was not great at money and became good at it. I had to learn it. It was not easy. So I have a ton of compassion for how hard it is. Mm-hmm. And that it, you know, that you have to find systems that work with your own brain. And I'm not a systems person. I don't have that kind of, like you, I wouldn't like natively create a spreadsheet for how I'm navigating my money. But when somebody shows me a system like that, I'm like, oh, that looks awesome. Like, can I use that? And so a lot of times it's like, what are we, you know, can we learn from somebody who's going to really understand our pain points? It's helpful.
Yeah. Well, my problem is, well, a lot of times I address a pain for people, but instead of giving people a pain pill, I like to give them a vitamin. It's an analogy that my buddy Nate Grahek came up with. He's like, Joel, a lot of people, they're just all about pain, 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 and you just want to keep giving people vitamins. You don't necessarily want to say there's something wrong here, people. You need to do something about it. You come across and say, hey, what you have might be great, but here's something that could be even cooler, even better. So I don't know how much pain I address in the world, but I do know that I like to give people vitamins.
Yeah, and it's a great analogy. Absolutely.
Okay, well, you can take this wherever you want, but I always like to ask a guest, is there anything we didn't talk about that you would like people to know?
I would like them to know that it's possible to heal your relationship with money, and that just because the tools or the processes or the people that you've tried to learn from in the past haven't worked, it doesn't mean you're stupid or inadequate. It simply means the tools weren't right or the timing wasn't right. It's really possible to learn. I was 42 years old, had no 401k, had never had a health insurance. I'd never had health insurance until I was 42. You can learn this stuff. You can get better at it. And the best thing I can offer is that you have to be willing to ask questions that might feel stupid. And there really are no stupid questions. There's just questions that aren't being asked. But learning and being committed to learning is really the very best way to become savvy. You know, how did you do that? What are you thinking? Why are you recommending this thing to me? Tell me more. I don't understand that.
Well, these are all questions I know you can help people answer. And that's not the only thing you have to offer, is your words. Well, words, but not necessarily what you're saying to us today. I know you are very gracious, and you have a resource that might be useful for smart and simple listeners. Z-Guide to Money, what's the deal with that?
Yeah, so Z-Guide is my answer to the fact that most people who invest or even just trying to begin the process of understanding how to navigate money don't understand the terminology. And so Z-Guide to Money is a visual field guide to financial terminology. So I go through things like what's a stock and what's a bond and what's asset allocation mean and what are the different pieces of an estate plan? How does taxation of accounts work? All these things that we sort of assume people know, and they just don't. People think they come in and they say, hey, do you have a Roth IRA and what's it paying? I'm like, okay, let's separate that out. A Roth IRA is an account, and what you put in it, the type of investment, is separate. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, and like, well, the bank has a Roth IRA for 2%. And I'm like, well, that's because the Roth IRA at the bank is a CD inside of a Roth IRA.
A certificate of deposit, which sometimes you have to explain to people. All these acronyms that we throw around. And yeah, some people are like, well, is that an acronym? What's Roth? Is Roth a guy? Is Roth a thing? Roth
was a guy. Roth was a senator.
Exactly.
Who basically said, hey, we need a better tool for people to save for retirement. If we want to ever get them to become more independent, we need a tool that's really going to be tax benefited. And that's what Roth did for us. So yeah, so this e-guide is it's 50 pages. It's a really quick read, and it's an opportunity to just really either check and see whether you do understand these terms or to learn them for the first time. And it's a very simple way to start to become a little bit more savvy. And you can even bring that z-guide into your insurance agent or your financial advisor or your estate planning attorney and say, well, I think it means this, but can you tell me more?
Yeah.
Because at least you're starting somewhere.
Absolutely. So how do I get it?
So it's on my website. And for your listeners, it's lunajaffe.com/zguide-giveaway.
Cool. I'll have a link to that in the show notes to make it very easy on people to get it. And is there somewhere else? You did mention your website, lunajaffe.com, which I know is where you do a lot of stuff, but you're found in a number of places online. Where else do you want us to come get your wisdom? Because you have a lot.
Well, that's the best resource. I have a lot to offer on that website. There's I do two different things that people who sign up on my website, you get. Once a week, I actually visually blog. I'm a visual artist, and so I create paintings and pair them up with quotes of my own. So those go out once a week just to give you a little snippet of something that's inspiring or thought-provoking. And then the other piece that comes out once a week is a newsletter or blog that really is addressing either something that I'm really, it's very personal. I'm looking at my own journey around money, conversations I have. There's a lot of interviews that I do, video interviews with other thought leaders. And there will be upcoming, because of Wild Money Monologues, I'm actually turning, we're filming Wild Money Monologues, and each monologue will be an individual blog post in the summer, over the summer, so people can see the 5 to 10, there'll be 5 to 7 minutes each. And so anywhere around the world that you are, you'll be able to see at least glimpses of what the entire performance was like.
Very cool. You know, I've never been more tempted to judge someone's work by their cover. In your case, literally, both with Wild Money and The Guide to Money. But it's the vibrancy, the colors, how lively, expressive, and how engaging it is to all my senses. Just seeing at the surface level what you do really gives me a good feel in terms of how you help people and the depth in which you go. So thank you for your work. Thank you for being a guest on the show. It's been a real treat.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
Boy, howdy, Luna. You really rocked the money landscape, and I'm sure you did the same for other people listening. It wasn't just me. And I personally am eager to take your comfort zone quiz now, right after I take you up on your gracious offer to me and the rest of the Smart and Simple Matters gang to download your Z Guide to Money for free. For free? Hot diggity. Let's all go get it from lunajaffe.com/Z Guide-giveaway, because no groovy gift like this will last forever. There'll be a link to Luna's free giveaway in the show notes at valueofsimple.com/SASM049, plus links to all the other wonderful stuff we talked about in this episode. I think it would be swell if you told Luna how much you appreciate her and her work on Twitter. You can see her at Luna Jaffe, LunaJaffe, or on her website, lunajaffe.com. Okay, so you're probably viewing the show notes right now at valuesimple.com/SASM049 and might be wondering what to do next. Well, can I ask you, have you left the show an iTunes review yet? Because each one helps other people discover our message and the wisdom of some really amazing guests, like Luna, for example. So if you like helping others in 2 minutes or less, go to valueofsimple.com slash iTunes and let me know what you think of the show in, you know, just a 1 to 2 sentence review. Doesn't have to be big time, but each review, I read them all. They fire me up, and you might even get a shout out at the top of a future show as well. Maybe episode 50, our next one. Oh, it's going to be a solo special edition of Smart and Simple Matters, chock full of everything you love. Simplifying, organizing, and being money wise, and the stuff we can use to get more of what we want and remove everything else that distracts us from it. You know, like minimalism, spreadsheets, curating, mastering relationships, great storytelling, that kind of stuff. Also, there are still tickets available for Simple Rev 2014 on October 3rd and 4th in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can score yours at simplerev.com/tickets to see me, Dan Hayes, Joshua Becker, Cheryl Balthrop, and more groovy folks rock the simple living landscape. We would love to have you join us and rock it too. But for now, here's a whole heaping, helping of gratitude for you for listening to another episode of the show. You ready for it? Boom. Boom. There you go. There's your verbal gratitude. I hope you felt it. It's now time for your partner in simplifying to sign off again. You've just listened to the Smart and Simple Matters podcast with Joel Zaslavsky, creator of all things value of simple.